Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. I'm Gail Seiler, your host for today. Thanks for tuning in, and Happy New Year. Because it's a new year, I'm thinking that perhaps one of your New Year's resolutions was to support KHOI. So now is the time to do that. You can make a donation or become a member of KHOI right now, today. Basic membership is $55, but you can donate any amount. The easiest way to donate is to go to the website, khoifm.org, and click the donate button on the left-hand side. It's quick and secure. Then you can cross that New Year's resolution off your to-do list, and you can rest easy that KHOI will continue to be there for you whenever you want to listen. It's the weekend, so I'm sure you are wondering what the weather will be over the next few days. Today, Friday, will be sunny and with a high of near 46 degrees. Overnight, it will be clear down to around 26. Tomorrow, Saturday, will be sunny up to 50 degrees for a high, and overnight, again, clear with a low in the 20s. Sunday will be cloudy with a high near 44 degrees, and then overnight, things change a bit on Sunday night. A 30% chance of rain, and then some rain and snow mixed, and that may continue into Monday as well. In the latter part of the show today, Susan Guiazda will be with us, and we'll hear about what's happening in the city of Ames as we roll into January. But before we get to that, we've got Dennis Hart with his first news roundup of 2019.
Thank you very much, Gail, and Happy New Year to you and to our listeners. It's good to be here on this first Friday of 2019. Let's start the way we usually do, with a look back at what made news last Saturday, when it was still 2018, in the Ames Tribune. And what made big news in the Trib that day was a Washington Post story that the mother of Molly Tibbetts, the University of Iowa student whose disappearance and killing attracted national attention, had taken in the son of Mexican immigrants who had worked with her daughter's accused killer. The Post reported that Laura Calderwood has brought 17-year-old Ulysses Felix into her home. His parents had worked alongside murder suspect Christian Bahena Rivera at a dairy farm in Brooklyn, Iowa. After Bahena Rivera's arrest, Ulysses' parents fled town and left their son behind. Also in Saturday's Trib, a feature story about how and why the Ames Police Department installed Sergeant Christine Crippen as a liaison to the LGBTQ community. A police spokesman said the department wanted to have resources for underrepresented groups to try to prevent bias-related crimes from taking place. Crippen has met with various inclusion affairs groups at Iowa State University and attended programs and meetings. Also last Saturday, the Trib reported on research conducted by an Iowa State University professor. Research that suggests a person's criminal history is a strong indicator for future violent crime. Sociology and criminal justice professor Matt DeLisi and his colleagues found that a person's prior conviction greatly increased the possibility for an offender to commit the same crime again. Those crimes were homicide, robbery, aggravated assault, burglary, and drug sales. There was more last Saturday, including a feature story about a soon-to-be 11-year-old boy from Huxley, who has been honored by the United Way of Story County as the Outstanding Youth in Philanthropy. Michael Weekman worked to collect cash donations and items for hygiene kits for homeless youth who live in Story County. He was able to assemble more than 100 hygiene kits, which were given to youth shelter services. And one more note from Saturday's paper, actually several stories on the sports pages, all about Iowa State University's football team and its loss to Washington State in the Alamo Bowl in San Antonio. The Cyclones lost 28-26, ending their otherwise successful season that featured 8 victories in 13 games. Sunday's Tribune reported that Story County's Coalition for Disaster Recovery was preparing for the new year with training, education, and other strategies. The CDR was created in 2003 and is a group of more than 40 organizations that want to build the community's ability to respond to disasters. Sunday's paper also had a story about a 9-year-old Nevada girl who made a big donation of supplies to the Story County Animal Shelter. Avon Heights gathered between $800 and $900 worth of animal products, such things as dog and cat food and treats, which she gave to the shelter. At home, Avon has 2 dogs and 2 guinea pigs, along with 3 rabbits and 4 cats. And yes, she wants to become a veterinarian. What took up most of the front page of last Sunday's Trib was a look back at the big events in Ames in 2018. Among the biggest stories, the killing of former Iowa State University student Celia Barquena Rosamena in September, the long discussion and finally action taken by the Ames City Council to set up rental cap limits in neighborhoods adjacent to Iowa State University, the rezoning of Lincoln Way between Grand and Duff Avenues, and a possible mixed-use construction project in the area by a Chicago developer, the increase in parking meter rates in July, which frustrated business owners who said the hike was too steep and was causing shoppers to avoid Main Street, the November election, which resulted, among other things, in the re-election of 4th Congressional District Republican Steve King and the elections of Democrats Linda Merkin to the Board of Supervisors and Ted Rasmussen to the Story County Treasurer's Office, the April election in which Ames voters approved a bond to build a new high school and to expand three of the district's elementary schools, the sale of the former DuPont ethanol plant in Nevada, the search for a new library director in Ames, the return of the Register's annual Great Bicycle Ride across Iowa to Ames, the success of the Iowa State University football team. And, of course, one of the big stories around Ames in 2018 was the weather. Snow and bitter cold early in the year, then heavy rain through the summer and tornadoes in July, three of them that caused minor damage in Story County, the same day that much more powerful tornadoes caused major damage in Marshalltown and Pella. Yes, it's hard to believe that all of that took place in just one year, last year, but it did, and the Trib has all the details in last Sunday's paper. The Trib is not published on Mondays. Tuesday's paper, the first edition of the new year 2019, featured a story about how Ames residents kicked off the new year with much colder temperatures. The forecast included a mix of sleet, freezing snow, and drizzle. Enough wet snow had fallen on New Year's Eve to leave a thin layer on sidewalks and area streets. Temperatures were not expected to warm up much on New Year's Day, and as it turned out, they didn't. Tuesday's paper also reported that the director of the Cambridge Memorial Library had retired after 47 years. Janet Thorson said her biggest joy over all those years was watching children grow up and graduate, get married, and have kids of their own. She began her career with the library by volunteering to help with the children's section and then started working on the library board. She was asked to serve as library director when Matilda Hill retired. Janet Thorson said she plans to keep busy in retirement. Meanwhile, Jay Robinson has taken over as her replacement at the Cambridge Library. And the New Year's Day Tribune also had word about a new business on Main Street in Collins. It's called the Small Town Tattoo Shop, and it's owned by Robbie Erickson. He opened the shop just a month ago after working for years at a tattoo business in Ankeny. He grew up in Grimes and said he's wanted to be a tattoo artist since he was in the fifth grade and read Ray Bradbury's book, The Illustrated Man. He said he's happy to be part of Main Street's growth in Collins. Wednesday's Tribune had word about a new report that indicated nearly half the calls you and I will get on our mobile phones this year will either be scams or robocalls. That report comes from First Orion, a provider of phone call and data transparency solutions. Scam calls are nothing new in Ames or Story County, but police said they've been increasing in recent years. Eric Snyder of the Ames PD told the Trib that fraudulent calls and communications have increased because scammers are using technology to reach the masses more easily than ever. And Snyder said some people are still hesitant to report if they've fallen victim to a scam. Wednesday's paper also had word on how food pantries in Ames were especially busy during the holiday season. Both the Bethesda Church Community Food Pantry and Food at First rallied their volunteers, received donations, and distributed meals to those in need. Food at First's recent community holiday meal fed 500 people and included food provided and prepared by residents. They cooked 26 turkeys, 40 pies, and 200 pounds of potatoes. Also Wednesday, the Trib reported that school-based mental health services will be provided to Roland Story students under a contract recently approved by the Roland Story School District. The board voted to approve a contract for mental health services with Ackerberg & Associates, which will provide the services to the district for a 22-week period. That agency will give 8 hours of therapy services to Roland Story students and their families each week. Those services will include mental health assessments, therapy, and referral to other agencies and resources. Services will be available at all three school buildings. The school district's cost for all this will be $8,800 and will be covered by federal funding. One more note from Wednesday's paper, word about yet another new business that's recently opened on Main Street in the community of Collins. This one is a gun shop, Barney's Gun Shop, owned by Bob Barnhill. Barnhill's place is in a building originally built in the late 1800s. He told the Trib he has a monitored alarm system and 24/7 video surveillance and reminded customers that all sales require a background check. Thursday's Trib, yesterday's, reported that incumbent Story County Supervisor Loris Olson was chosen as the new board chairman on Wednesday. This after third-term Supervisor Rick Sanders and newcomer Linda Merkin were sworn in following their victories in this past November's election. Ted Rasmussen was also sworn in as Story County's new treasurer. During the supervisors' meeting, the board discussed the process of appointing commissioners to the Veterans Affairs Commission, a discussion that will continue in coming weeks. The board also decided to continue producing abbreviated YouTube previews and reviews of board meetings, and also to continue meeting at 10 a.m. on Tuesdays. Also Thursday, the Trib had word that the Story County Sheriff's Office had received a bundle of care packages from Operation Gratitude, a company that helps community members thank military personnel and first responders. The company gave the Sheriff's Office packages that include a survival bracelet, hand sanitizers, hand warms, a 5-hour energy drink, and a protein bar, among other things. Local volunteers will help deliver the packages to military personnel and first responders. Yesterday's paper also reported that members of AIMS Amnesty International Group 40 are using pen and paper to fight worldwide injustices. Group 40 coordinator Mary Sand and others spend monthly meetings researching human rights cases and sending letters to prisoners, family members, government officials, and others in countries including Iran, Pakistan, and Brazil. Those letters have one central message: human rights. And one more note from yesterday's paper, a traditional one for this time of year, a report about the first baby of 2019 born at Mary Greeley Medical Center. His name is Aiden Lamar Small, and he was born at 1:32 a.m. on New Year's morning. His parents are Celeste and Charles Small. And, just for the record, newborn Aiden came into the world weighing just a bit more than 8 pounds. And there you have it, Gail, our summary of the past week's news from the pages of the Ames Tribune. I'm Dennis Hart. Happy to have been here with you on this first Friday of the new year, and reminding you that I'll be right back here this coming Monday with a look at what made news around Iowa as 2019 kicked off. In the meantime, I hope you have a safe and happy weekend.
Monopoly 21, checkers and chess. Yeah, 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 yeah. Mr. Fred Lassie in a breakfast mess. Yeah, 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 yeah. Let's play Twister, let's play Risk. Yeah, 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 yeah. I'll see you in heaven if you make. Now, Andy, did you hear about this one? Tell me, are you locked in the pond? Andy, are you goofing on Elvis, too, baby? Are we losing touch? If you believe they put a man on the moon, man on the moon.
That was Man on the Moon by R.E.M. On last Friday's show, we heard an audio story produced by one of the students in a course that I taught at ISU this past semester. Today, we're going to hear another of those podcasts. The course was about equity in education, and it is for master's students who are obtaining their certification to teach secondary grades. For example, the students in the course are becoming science teachers or math or agriculture teachers. In the course, we delved into the role that education plays in perpetuating injustices in society, as well as what teachers can and should do to interrupt those injustices. One of the goals of the course was to recognize that all of us have a worldview that is based on our own limited experiences, what we call our cultural bubble. To expand their cultural bubble, students listened to a podcast series that would give them the perspective of a group that they were unfamiliar with. After listening to their selected podcast, the students had an assignment in which they produced their own podcast or radio story. Today, we are going to hear another of the radio stories produced by a student in the course. Today's story is by Catherine Williams, a master's student in agriculture education.
Hello, and welcome to the podcast. I am your host, Catherine, and thank you for tuning in. Today, we are going to be diving into an issue in agriculture that I don't believe receives much of the spotlight. But before we get there, I want us to do a quick little activity together. If you can, close your eyes, and I want you to picture the first thing that comes to mind when I say a word. Don't dwell or change your mind, just focus on that first thing. Okay? Farmer. Some of you might have pictured the stereotypical farmer, an older man wearing overalls and a plaid shirt, maybe has a pitchfork or a piece of straw sticking from his mouth. Some of you may have pictured an object related to farming, such as a tractor, or some of you may have just seen the word farmer. Whatever you saw, I'm going to take a wild guess in saying that it didn't include the very topic we're going to be talking about today. So let's get to it. Over the past few years, the LGBTQ, or lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer community has been more visible in the agricultural industry. From being farm operators to leaders at the highest level of agricultural business, to changing long-lasting government statements to be more inclusive of sexual orientation, gender identity, and gender expression. The efforts we will discuss today help us to understand the obstacles people in the LGBTQ community face, but I hope by the end of this episode, you realize the amount of work that still needs to be done to improve the inclusivity of the LGBTQ community in this industry. I don't think this will come as a shock to anyone listening that the LGBTQ community hasn't necessarily been welcomed with open arms. In 2016, Seedstock.com published an article addressing this directly, titled, "In the Face of Discrimination, LGBTQ Farmers Have Hope for the Future." Quotes that begin the article help us to understand what LGBTQ farmers face as people in the agriculture industry. Ryan Reed, a writer in the International Gay Rodeo Association, says, "I grew up on a family farm, but there's no place for me on the farm. The future's not there." He is directly talking about him taking over his family business. Gay and lesbian farmers Nathan Looney from Los Angeles and Ari Rosenberg from Philadelphia both also share that being LGBTQ has impacted their ability to be successful in rural agriculture. Both are urban farmers in their respective cities. All three believe that there is hope for the future and are optimistic and about the opportunities that will become available to LGBTQ agriculturalists. But they also believe this will take time to accomplish. However, this is not to say LGBTQ agriculturalists are standing down to those that oppose them. Rather, they are trying to grow in the industry, as was indicated in the Huffington Post in 2017. In early 2017, the outspoken conservative radio host Rush Limbaugh made comments on his show claiming that lesbian farmers were a threat to America, specifically rural states. This is all in reaction to the USDA's partnership with the National Center for Lesbian Rights supporting the hashtag Rural Pride campaign. The hashtag Rural Pride campaign was developed to increase the visibility of the LGBTQ community in rural America and increase their access to services and resources available through the federal government. This initiative is one way LGBTQ advocacy is growing in the United States and is what I believe to be a stepping stone to a brighter future for agriculture as a whole. One reality that we need to start paying more attention to is that sexual orientation or gender identity don't make much of an impact on your ability to produce food, make a difference in your community from a physical labor perspective. Liz Grasnack is the owner-operator of Happy Hollow Farm in Jamestown, Missouri, where she operates a 7-acre certified organic vegetable farm. She participates in farmers markets every weekend of the year, helps make a community-supported agriculture program, or CSA, possible, and sells her produce to local grocers and restaurants each harvest season. Local farmers give tremendous opportunity to their communities through projects and services such as those from the Happy Hollow Farm, but also through donations to food pantries to help fill their shelves and with fresh produce for families that may not be able to access produce otherwise. The point I'm trying to make here is that welcoming anyone who is willing to grow food ultimately helps to produce and support the local community, regardless of who is growing that food. This also helps us to support more food for the rest of the world, too. But we're still here talking about how those in the LGBTQ community have to fight for their place in agriculture. This is where we start our discussion about social justice and what this means for the future of the agriculture industry. Culture and society have a tremendous impact on how we view other people. Sensoy and D'Angelo define culture as the norms, values, practices, patterns of communication, language, laws, customs, and meanings shared by a group of people located in a given time and place in their book, Is Everyone Really Equal? Each of us belongs to multiple cultures. Our family culture, our community culture, our regional culture, our national culture, and each of these expand out into a variety of unique cultures depending on our personal connections. From these cultures, ideas of what is normal are developed, and traditionally, people of the LGBTQ community have not been viewed as a cultural norm in the United States. But maybe times are changing for the better. I firmly believe that diversity is the key to new ideas that lead to innovations, ultimately leading to building the future. And we need a variety of minds to accomplish this. However, changing the mind of society isn't so easy. Society has helped to create dominant narratives that paint the picture of LGBTQ as different and not normal to those of us who aren't members of the LGBTQ community. Because of this, many in the LGBTQ community remain closeted to keep their jobs and generally stay safe. But what if they didn't really have to feel this way? Maybe they hold the key idea to change their future, but as we suppress them, they may never share it, and we aren't any better off than we were before. Let's see how maybe this is changing. One example of forward movement in paving the way for LGBTQ leaders is the recent promotion of Beth Ford of the Land O'Lakes Corporation to CEO in 2018. Ford, formerly COO at Land O'Lakes, is an openly gay woman and is alone in that among the leaders of Fortune 500 companies. She and Apple's Tim Cook are the only openly gay leaders currently leading Fortune 500 companies at all. What is notable about this is Land O'Lakes is one of the largest companies in the agriculture and food industries today. And through promoting Ford, they have made history and have started opening the door for the LGBTQ community to become more visible in the industry. Another global leader that is making an impact for the LGBTQ community is Bayer. Bayer, most famous for their pharmaceuticals, also has their hands in many industries, including agriculture and food. Bayer boasts that diversity is a fixed part of the corporate culture at Bayer. The company has created a community called Blend that was established by LGBTQ community employees to raise awareness of the LGBTQ issues and improve the corporate culture to help employees feel more open to share their personality and ideas. Bayer employees are encouraged to participate in a variety of celebrations for the LGBTQ community around the world as well. As for government support of LGBTQ, there are some notable highlights that should be mentioned, but there's still a lot of work to be done. Under USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack, the LGBT Emphasis Program was created and joins a family of special information and employment programs underneath the USDA for women, disabled workers, and various racial groups within the agencies and programs overseen by the USDA. Also under Vilsack's leadership, a change in the USDA's non-discrimination statement to include sexual orientation, gender identity, and gender expression was made. However, it seems that the efforts like those from Bayer and Land O'Lakes have not yet been adopted by the federal government. Today, as you scan the USDA and agency websites, there's actually very little information that can be found beyond some basic program guidelines and who to contact for more information. It also appears that these efforts have been reserved in the states of Oregon and Washington and not promoted nationwide. While this is a start, I think there's plenty of room to grow and expand these opportunities for the LGBTQ community. This is where advocacy and allies are most important. If you're not a member of the LGBTQ community, but are close to someone who is, find a way to support them. Feeling like someone has your back and is there to help you can be the only thing that is needed to kickstart critical change. Take the example of Bayer, where employees rallied around each other to create Blend. Maybe just to feel supported at an event where they want to be viewed as another person with thoughts and ideas, and they just want to share them freely without judgment. Help make this a reality in more spaces within agriculture. I hope today you have learned a little more about how the LGBTQ community is involved in agriculture and the potential impact they have in creating a brighter future for us all. We need everyone who has a passion for agriculture to join us. Why should we continue to exclude anyone from our industry? I hope this has broadened your perspective, and thank you for listening.
That was Catherine Williams, a master's student at ISU studying agriculture education. She prepared that podcast as an assignment for a course on social justice education that I taught last semester. Catherine also told me about a national group that she came across in her research. It's called Cultivating Change, and it is a nonprofit whose mission is valuing and elevating LGBT agriculturalists through advocacy, education, and community. And this organization will be having their annual national conference in Des Moines this year. The theme is Celebrating Agriculture, Celebrating People. It will be held from June 19th to the 21st, like I said, in Des Moines. We'll be having several other upcoming stories on LGBTQ-related topics. We hope to bring you an interview with the new LGBTQ liaison for Ames Police, and a story about the firing of the 4-H director in Iowa in relation to LGBTQ inclusivity statement. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI. That's 89.1 FM. One of the things that brings great joy, particularly in winter, is to see birds. And many people like to bring birds to their yards by feeding them. Our resident naturalist, Pat Schlaubaum, put together these tips on establishing a bird feeding station in your backyard.
Starting a bird feeding program. Anyone who has enjoyed listening to songbirds and watching their colorful flight can appreciate seeing a favorite bird at their bird feeder. Feeding birds has become a multi-million dollar industry supported by people of all professions and ages. Bird feeding benefits people who enjoy seeing birds at close range. Feeders offer a food supplement for songbirds, but seldom provide all of a healthy bird's diet. However, local bird populations seem to benefit from stable feeding regimes, especially at nesting time. While winter feeding focuses on viewing, summer feeding and an accompanying bird bath can provide tremendous entertainment. It's thrilling to see a mother cardinal coax her young to the feeding station for the first time, or to hear the chickadees and house finches welcoming a refill. Songbirds are much more vocal in summertime and contribute to the aesthetics of anyone's backyard. Bird feeders should be located near a favorite window. Songbirds prefer protected areas out of prevailing winds. So locate feeders near shrubs or thickets with a sunny exposure where possible. Shrubs provide quick escape cover from attacking predators, but avoid placing feeders too close to shrubs if neighborhood cats threaten birds at your feeders. A feeder designated to provide a continuous supply of seed is called a hopper style, as opposed to a feeder containing only a small food supply that requires daily refilling and maintenance. Hopper style feeders need to be designed to keep the seed as dry as possible and to minimize waste. Different species of birds have varying feeding habits, so it is good to incorporate as many feeding options as possible into a good backyard feeder design. The bird feeder on the opposite page has been designed to keep the seed as dry as possible, to minimize waste, and to appeal to a range of bird species. A roof with a 2-inch minimum overhang is required to ensure a dry feeding area. Cedar wood swells when wet, providing additional tightness. The curved slot is positioned under the drip line of the roof and provides aeration to the platform side of the feeder. The feeding area is recessed trough with screened holes to provide aeration and subsequent drying. A dry feeder is a better feeder and will last longer. Moldy seeds may cause aspergillosis, a deadly bird disease caused by Aspergillosis fumigatus, a common widespread mold that grows on wet grain and bread. The trough feeding area is also designed to minimize seed waste. Occasionally, birds such as house sparrows will throw seeds from the feeding area onto the ground, but the narrow trough area is not conducive to this behavior. Sunflower seeds, especially black oil sunflower seeds, are favorites of cardinals, chickadees, nuthatches, titmice, and at least 40 other species. And when feeding seed mixtures, some birds will kick less preferred seeds out of the feeder onto the ground to rot, so it is best to offer only sunflower seeds in the feeder rather than mixing it with other grains. Ground-feeding birds, such as juncos and true sparrows, prefer white millet but will eat dropped sunflower seeds. The length of the feeder allows more than one bird to eat at a time. Blue jays can be quite territorial, but a length greater than 10 inches provides additional space for less aggressive birds to feed. And at 10 inches, you can have one nuthatch come in on one side and another nuthatch come in from the other end, and they won't be so territorial. But it takes about 10 inches of separation. Perches offer chickadees and tufted titmice a place to hold the sunflower seed by their feet as they eat. Lacking perches, these birds will fly to the nearest branch, possibly out of view, to eat the seed. Birds such as nuthatches will use any crack to wedge the seed where they hammer it open. And ground-feeding birds, like juncos and cardinals, prefer flat surfaces to land upon. A platform board attached to the feeder entices these birds, including woodpeckers. And a wire mesh side container can offer suet or peanuts. Peanuts are a favorite food of tufted titmice and downy woodpeckers. To attract the greatest variety of birds, consider providing different types of feeders. Tube feeders containing Niger seed will attract finches. The goldfinches are state bird. Although finches also eat sunflower seeds at a hopper feeder. And feeders spaced at various locations in heights allow less dominant species a means to fly away from more aggressive birds. And aggressive birds, that would kind of include the nuthatches and blue jays primarily. And here's some suggestions on some things you can do around your bird feeder. Occasionally, birds fly into windows. Stunned birds can be put into a paper bag, folded down at the top, and held closed by a clothespin, and placed in a cool, quiet place like a closet. After about 30 minutes, take the bag outside, take away the clothespin, and hopefully your revived bird will fly from the bag. Marauding cats that threaten feeding birds should have a bell attached to their collar to warn the birds of their presence. Landscaping should be kept at 12, 14 feet so that marauding cats can't lay in wait right at the feeder when their birds arrive. And sometimes hawks, especially sharp-shinned and Cooper's hawks, will disrupt feeding birds. Shrubs planted near the feeding stations should provide protective cover, escape cover, for the birds. However, the best approach may be to simply stop feeding for a time. The birds will then disperse to natural feeding areas or other more protected feeders in your community. Bird feeders should be cleaned annually with a mild bleach solution to inhibit mold growth. And lastly, house sparrows can be deterred from monopolizing the feeder by hanging monofilament fishing line around the feeder or draped from a halo above the feeder, or by feeding cracked corn or grains, which are their favorite foods, away from the main bird feeding area. And maintaining a healthy bird feeding station could provide immeasurable entertainment possibilities for your family and friends. The opportunity to share the oneness with the natural world that songbirds can provide is well worth the effort of setting up a bird feeding station at your home. This environmental update is sponsored by the Outdoor Alliance of Story County, Story County's Conservation's Friends Group, working to enhance outdoor recreation, education, and conservation. Information can be found at www.oasco.org.
Thanks to Pat for that information on how to keep the birds happy in our backyards and us happy watching them, because it's a beautiful thing to do, particularly in winter. We now have with us Susan Guiazda, the Public Relations Officer for the City of Ames. Thanks for coming in today.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
On this first week of January, the holidays are over. It's a new year. So what do we need to know about what's happening in Ames?
Well, we were just talking about the unseasonably warm weather, and that's been great. And we love to see so many people outside enjoying the weather. We were the recipient recently of an outdoor ice rink from Wells Fargo Bank and the Iowa Wild, which has been fantastic. We have installed that ice rink at South River Valley Park here in Ames, off 13th Street, unfortunately, with this warm weather, we haven't had the best luck opening the ice rink.
Mm-hmm.
So this would just serve as a reminder. We do have signs out there. You know, red is no, the rink is closed. Green is go ahead and skate. And we really ask that skaters pay attention to those signs. So these ice rinks are portable in the meaning that at the end of the season, we tear them down and move them out,
mm-hmm.
and they have plastic liners. So if you skate on an ice rink that is not completely frozen and your skate breaks through it all, it'll slice that liner right up. Open, and then we can't fill it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So we really ask that people respect the signs, and we've had great compliance so far, but I know people are so excited to get out and skate, and skating outside is pretty wonderful. We were just talking before that you have lived places where skating rinks are open. And
in Canada, many outdoor rinks are available to people in parks, in little communities everywhere.
And I grew up in Ames, and one of the places we used to skate was at Homewood Golf Course under the stars, you know, surrounded by trees.
Yeah.
It was beautiful. And we get the excitement and the fun of ice skating outside. And we just ask that people pay attention to the weather. It's usually pretty obvious. A day like today, it's not going to be open. And if you look at the extended forecast, it looks questionable.
Yeah, for the next week or so at least. And there are two rinks?
There are two rinks. So we already had a skating rink. It had been at Homewood. We moved it over to South River Valley. And so that rink, along with the donated rink from the Iowa Wild, are put up next to each other.
Okay.
The rink from the Iowa Wild has bashboards. And so it's
for
more
hockey.
For hockey.
Yeah.
It's a better place to play hockey. The other rink is now more for recreation. Mm-hmm. And figure skating.
So, right. But people should look for the green sign saying they're ready to be skated on.
Yes, rink open, and then the red one says rink closed. So, yes, that was exciting news, but it may be a little
bit wild.
Hopefully
the weather will cooperate.
And we are planning a ribbon cutting for that, and we will let people know when that is. I know people, if you're out in that direction, if you happen to be going down East 13th Street, remember you can return your Christmas tree if you'd like to recycle it. If you have a live tree and it's looking a little dry or worse for the wear, you can drop off your Christmas tree at the Parks and Recreation Maintenance Building at 700 East 13th Street, or I like to say that's at the bottom of the Cemetery Hill. We chip those Christmas trees up and we use them in the parks for mulch. So the pile is growing. People are dropping off the Christmas trees. Please remove the tinsel, the tree stand, of course, any ornaments. You want to get all that out. And you can drop it off during what we call daylight hours. The maintenance facility doesn't have to be open. It can be on the weekend. But just during daylight hours, drive in, you know, self-drop your tree and drive out and everything is good.
And so you prefer that people do that than just put it out with trash?
It probably is one of the only ways you can recycle a tree right now is to drop it off at that facility.
Okay.
And we do get a lot by the end of January, and then we ask people to drop them off by the end of January. It's pretty full down there. So we had an announcement yesterday. We announced the promotion of two fire shift commanders to deputy fire chief. So we welcome Tom Hackett and Doug Allen, who've been with the City of Ames Fire Department for quite some time, who were promoted, and they begin their new duties immediately. We had two vacancies because we lost our fire chief, who went off into the academic world to teach. Sean Bayouth left us, and Rich Higgins was promoted to fire chief, an internal promotion. He had been the deputy fire chief, so and then we had a retirement. Paul Sandoval had been with us for decades, and so those two positions were filled recently, and it's always nice when we were able to promote from within, and we have some long-term history and experience on the fire department. So we welcome Doug and Tom to those leadership positions.
All right. Congratulations to them for being promoted and staying with Ames.
Yeah. Some things coming up this month, just so people should be aware of. Monday, January 21st. Is Martin Luther King Day, a day of celebration and I think a day of reflection and then a day of history. Ames has had a long-standing tradition of doing a big event a big celebration at the Ames Middle School. They will do that again this year from 6 o'clock. They'll start with birthday cake. And the actual program starts at 6:30 on Monday, January 21st, Ames Middle School Auditorium. The Ames Human Relations Commission, a commission appointed by the Ames City Council, as well as the Ames Police Department and several City of Ames staff are involved in this event. And so we always like to encourage people to attend. Meeker School Chorus will be there, Ames High Step Team, and a keynote presentation by Renee Hardman, who was the first African-American elected to the West Des Moines City Council, will be the speaker. It's always a really nice presentation. It's always very, very well attended, which always makes me so happy to see so many people there. And it's at a time of year where things are a little slow, I always find. Mm-hmm. So nice. I hope people will put that on their calendar. Great, great opportunity for a family event.
And some people like to use Martin Luther King Day as a day of service.
Right.
And I know that Story County Volunteers has sign up available on their website for particular volunteer opportunities on that day that people could check out. It always fills up, so you need to do it early.
And here's kind of a weird thing about that holiday is that there is no school.
Right.
But it is not a holiday for city employees. And I don't really know the history of that, uh-huh. although it always throws people because when days that are federal holidays are not city holidays, we do things like enforce parking.
Okay,
so
good
that's
to know.
Just a warning to people that parking will be enforced on January 21st. The one that surprises people then is in February, city employees are off for President's Day and there's
so
no
that's
parking.
A holiday.
There's no parking
okay.
enforced on that day.
All right.
So I'm not quite sure what happened there, but we have a little bit of a different schedule. So be aware. Speaking of the Human Relations Commission, we have vacancies on many of our boards and commissions. Serving on a city board or commission is something that is available to any Ames citizen. You have to live within the city of Ames to put your name in the hat for that. But it is an opportunity to serve on an advisory commission for the Ames City Council. And there are 18 boards and commissions that cover a lot of different interests and topics. For example, if you're interested in the park system, we have Parks and Recreation Commission. We have a Library Board of Trustees, the Ames Human Relations Commission. There's a Planning and Zoning Commission. Really, just about every interest, Public Art Commission. There is an opportunity to get involved. Mm-hmm. And there's several reasons why people get involved. Some people look at this opportunity to maybe dabble in politics. A lot of our council members and mayors have had experience serving on a board and commission, and that is certainly a great reason to get involved. But some people just want to serve and want to give of their time. So if you're interested, applications to serve on one of these boards or commissions are due 5 p.m. Friday, February 8th. And that is a hard 5 p.m. Friday, February 8th. You can turn in an application on our website at cityofames.org/board-and-commissions. You can request by phone at the city clerk's office, 239-5101. You can request an application be sent to you and fill it out on a hard copy. Just get it in by that date. But on the website, there's a lot of information that explains the different boards and commissions. And I think a key feature is when they meet. Because mm-hmm. people need to know, is this going to fit in my schedule? For example, public art will meet over the lunch hour, whereas planning and zoning will meet at night. Mm-hmm. There's the URAB board, which is an advisory group for the electric utility. That meets as needed. So, you know, some of them are meeting monthly. Some of them are meeting every other month. Some meet more than monthly and some meet as needed.
So different levels of commitment that people need to be aware of.
Absolutely. And the mayor is responsible for appointing people to commissions. And what the mayors I've worked with have looked for is balance. They look for commissions to be balanced, gender balanced, in a way that reflects a geographic location. So where you live in the community, they look for lots of different kinds of ways to balance those commissions to reflect the community at large. And so they ask that you put in like preferences of like 1 to 3 commissions that you think you could serve on. And, you know, people ask, well, you know, I'm not an artist. Can I serve on the Public Art Commission? Well, you know, Absolutely. It's just simply having an interest or a passion for that. You know, if you're on the library board, you're not necessarily an author. You're just somebody who has an interest in creating the best possible public library there is. And so that's really what we're looking for, that commitment. Not necessarily a skill set, but it doesn't, you know, hurt if you have a particular skill set that aligns with a board or commission. That's really something that the application tries to let you explain why you have an interest. And if you are an artist, then maybe a public art commission is a good fit for you. Okay. So
that's a great opportunity for people to get involved.
Yeah. I keep kind of skipping around, but some calendar items. It's every couple of years, FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, looks at what we call the floodplain maps. And the floodplain maps are what is used to indicate if property is required to buy flood insurance. Now, as you have probably noticed, we've had some rain events in the last couple of years that are pretty extreme. And we've also had some flooding in areas where we've never had it before. So those flood maps change over time. A river is constantly moving, and and the rain amounts will affect where that water flows. So the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, combined with FEMA, will be holding a public open house on Wednesday, January 16th, to present new floodplain maps to Story County residents. So from 5:30 to 7:30, the City of Ames Water Plant, the new water plant at 1800 East 13th Street, will be the host site for that event. It is a come-and-go kind of open house, so it's not something where you have to come for a presentation. But if you have property that has been designated as is in the floodplain or near the floodplain, you will want to make sure that you come and look at this. And or you're just curious about if how those maps have changed. If you're near a floodplain and you've never been included in the past, you might want to look and see if you're closer or if you're further away. And again, there is the financial result that if the floodplain map changes and your property is touched, you may be required to buy flood insurance. And so I think it will be of interest to a lot of people. Again, this is the first. These are not final. This is the first meeting. Again, Wednesday, January 16th from 5:30 to 7:30 at the new water plant. Information is on our website if people are curious about that, as well as a link to those preliminary floodplain maps, or I think it just a general overview of one of them. So cityofames.org/floodplain. We were speaking just a little bit ago about the different boards and commissions. One of our commissions, the Public Art Commission, has it works hard to bring art at all different levels to the community, and they are hosting a birdhouse competition. Kind of a fun spring event where you can build a birdhouse, and if they will have a contest, and these birdhouses will be sort of juried and put on display, and then at the Octagon, and then they'll be installed in our parks. So a really kind of a fun thing to use some creativity, you know. I always consider this kind of January, February, March time to be kind of dreary, and it's always fun to have a project. So,
And so they have to – the goal is that they'll be artistic and look nice, but that they'll also be functional.
Absolutely. And although there is a category called whimsy, which is not for display. I mean, so if you're just somebody who likes to create and maybe get really, really fancy on your birdhouse. But there's age groups. There are lots of categories on how you could submit your birdhouse. And there's even going to be, if you don't want to build it, they're looking at getting kits so you could, you know, really work on the decor instead of the build. We have information on our website, cityofames.org/birdhouses. Carrie Dixon, a public art commission member, is kind of taking lead on that. Her contact information's on the website, as well as we ask people fill out an application and get additional information. But a fun, maybe a family project, mm-hmm. if you're just sort of creative or if you love birds. We just heard about birds.
That's right. We just had tips from Pat.
Yeah. So and then these pieces of kind of art will be installed. Different birdhouses attract different birds. So we'll have to kind of determine where the birdhouses will go based on where the parks are located.
Right. Okay. So that sounds like a fun thing. Well, I think we're about out of time. I hope you got to tell us about at least most of the things you had there
well,
in front
of
you.
Well, I have an endless supply of things.
Well, thank you very much, Susan.
It's great to be here.
We've been talking with Susan Guiazda, the Public Relations Officer for the City of Ames. And as she mentioned, much of the information on the things she talked about can be found on the City of Ames website. And we'll put a link to that when we put the show on KHOI's website. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday and Wednesday, and at 5 p.m. on Friday. You can also listen to today's Local Talk show and all of our past shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Aladdin Al-Kathiri. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards. Other music we heard was Man on the Moon by R.E.M. Thanks to the other voices we heard on today's show, Dennis Hart with the news, Catherine Williams for her segment on LGBTQ issues in agriculture, and of course Susan Guiazda from the City of Ames. Remember, your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening and see you again on the radio. And don't forget about your New Year's resolution to become a member of KHOI.